Good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Karen Giussone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals. And it's my real pleasure to welcome you all here tonight on behalf of the New York Public Library. We're thrilled to be hosting Periodically Speaking. This is our fourth year of our collaboration. We have this great collaboration with CLMP, where we're able to showcase literary magazines, where we're able to provide a venue for writers to read their new work and also give editors an opportunity to talk about their journal. We love literary magazines here, so I want to just invite you to come back and check out the library's collection. We have a great collection here. So come back and visit us either in person or at nypl.org. Also at nypl.org these days you'll find podcasts of four of the recent Periodically Speaking events. So we're real excited about that. And if you go to the website, you can find them under our digital collections. And actually, just recently, we're one of the top 10 picks of things being downloaded from the library's website. So we're excited about that. Also, I want to invite you to stay around after, where we'll have a reception, which is held right outside in the hall. So I hope you can all join us for that. Thank you to Tasha and Jeffrey at CLMP. A real pleasure to work with them. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Jeffrey Leppendorf, who's the executive director at CLMP, and he's going to introduce tonight's program. So thank you very much for coming, and enjoy.
Thank you, Karen, and welcome to all of you. A very quick word about CLMP for those of you who may not be familiar with us. The Council of Literary Magazines and Presses was founded a little over 40 years ago by a group of magazine publishers, George Plimpton, Russell Banks, who then was not the novelist you know now, but the publisher of Lilla Bolero, and several others, as a way to help small publishers back then, in fact, only literary magazines, and since then, small presses as well, through the business of publishing. So we help around 500 small publishers, the folks, quite frankly, most responsible for really keeping literature alive in this country as an art form that one can have access to as a reader through technical assistance on all kinds of very unsexy topics. So that's our job, so that the publishers can do the sexy stuff, getting the sexy writing to sexy readers. By the way, those of you listening at home on a podcast, we're in a magnificent room here, and we're really lucky to be in this fantastic room. Mahogany, I think, lined walls. And all of us reading and presenting are tall, slim, and beautiful. and the first person in the list of tall, slim, and beautiful people I would like to welcome up here is Honor Moore, who, of course, many of you also know as a wonderful, wonderful writer, to talk to you a little bit about a new journal, newish journal, How H.O.W. Helping Orphans Worldwide. Welcome, Honor, who, by the way, was quite a contender at the recent CLMP spelling bee, but I won't make her spell anything.
Well, I'm very happy to be in this amazing room and very happy to participate in something, the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, which has always been this really important force in journal and small press publishing. Thank you, Tasha, for arranging this, and Jeffrey and Karen. It's a kind of special evening for me because I teach in the graduate program at the New School, and one of the founding editors of How Journal was a student of mine, Allison Weaver, and she and Natasha Rajodic, a novelist from Bosnia, Bosnian-American novelist, founded this journal in 2006. They had two interests that they were trying to integrate. One was that they were very moved and dismayed by the situation of orphans worldwide who were orphaned as a result of HIV. And they're both writers. So how are they going to bring these two interests and passions together? And they decided to, start a very profitable business. That would be a literary journal. And they've traveled in Africa and elsewhere to meet two orphanages, and they do manage to make contributions and have fundraisers for the orphanages. And they also are publishing this really beautiful journal, nonfiction, poetry, and fiction, and also art. And I am honored, privileged to be their poetry editor. And I guess I'm going to say that there are 15 million children throughout the world who have been orphaned by HIV/AIDS. And their website is howjournal.com. For submissions, we're eager for new writers to join us. Also, a great pleasure for me is introducing Laura Kronk. Lately, I've been calling you Laura Kronk. Anyway, Laura Kronk, who is a wonderful poet and who was also my student in a class in poetry and translation at the New School MFA program in 2003. And I asked her if I could tell this story, which is the story I always tell about her, was that we were listening to a recording of Neruda reading his own poems in Spanish. And I looked over to Laura, who happened to be sitting next to me, and a tear was coursing down her cheek. And I knew then, A, that she was the real thing as a poet, and B, that we were soulmates. And so it is my great pleasure to introduce her. Her poems have appeared in Barrow Street, Conduit, Lit, Lyric, No Tell Motel, and other journals, and in the anthologies Best American Poetry 2006 and 2008, The Bedside Guide to No Tell Motel, and Best American Erotic Poems from 1800 to the Present. She also co-curates the KGB Monday Night Poetry Series with Michael Quattrone at the KGB Bar in Manhattan, and in her spare time, oversees the Riggio Honors Program, Writing and Democracy for undergraduates at the New School. She lives in Jersey City with her husband and very young and beautiful 8-month-old daughter, Laura Kronk.
Thank you so much, Honor, and thank you to Karen at the library and Jeffrey and Tasha of CLMP. I'm really thrilled to be here and to be reading in this gorgeous room. I'm going to open with a poem I wrote at the time I was in Honor's class, and it's the poems that I was working on then have spun into a series that I'm still working on. This poem is called Collapse. My rule and my reach will collapse into a shadow of hair, collapse further into a stain on the floor. Body so watery and delicate, living on air and prepared dishes, laced into air. There is little time. I have no other way to know it. This smallness frets me. No, I fret it. I am laced in tight to it. Breathlessness, throats I slit or would have slit to prevent my own slitting, to remain for even a moment more. The police will descend and ascend, moving up and down the ladder of heaven. When I look at them to join them, I will be spitting. I will be as horrid as anything dying, as unapproachable, ladylike nature intact, not tacked on, but in and spilling out. My governance, my jurisdiction is tainted with cowardliness, with what I've done for my own advance, with the horror of the shots I fired coming up from behind at night, leaving trails of water. The path I took running made lasting patterns of salt water. Now the dead can be buried by water. That at least pleased me, and so I sang. The revolutionaries stack themselves as wood and burn, then stack themselves again and burn. Their demand is fair, my end, but I can't. I have a very small time left in the palace. I've got to go out on the balcony again and feel the air. I'm going to move into newer poems which kind of spun out of that place. Having anonymously entered the palace, I climb the tower stairs, my breath puffs hot in the air. Coming upon a small cut window in the spiral, I look out to an icicled world, coldness arched over everything. The skirts I've worn outside drag heavy up the tight passageway, collecting frozen dust, the wool damp and darkening. I could have taken the elevator, but no, not when I have the royal feeling burning. I'd been reading the paper again. Not when I'm ready to see something and respond. Like the others, this is a fake feeling. I reach my door and need a key for the lock. My apartment door is number 21. The super had slipped a note under, which I step over. I go straight for the back in search of my best, my most sumptuous, most well-fitted clothes. I went straight for the back, but now I'm pacing, pacing. I'll never read the paper again. I mean, come on. From my window, I see boys in big coats. They're signing up on the drafty sidewalk, signing clipboards. In a flash, I see it, what's happening so far away, and it seizes me. What was I thinking? It could have been avoided. I should have spoken sooner. I wear the brooch that makes me a general. I sit in the deepest chamber of my apartment, dressed to kill and issue orders. But I send them out and get nothing back. Send them out and get nothing back. Having paraded over the bridge, I sat in the deepest chamber of my apartment, dressed to kill and issued orders, but I sent them out and got nothing back. That I thought the king was mine, madness. That I thought I could stop him if only I conjured the right thought. Like praying, I thought that what I did inside meant something. Alone in the house, without a scuttle or a squeak, the king, the ruler, the czar, the mafioso doesn't know my name. I could say, back when I wasn't the boss, I was in a much less good mood, and everything follows on the spangled light of that. Having been turned down, the world's leaders don't want to come to dinner. It's true that I used to be in a much worse mood. It's true that the lighting has improved. Here's to that. Starlit parties are mine to throw. They're mine, no matter who's coming. I have my own ruling class, my own personal celebrity. I've tried the other way, but wearing a kerchief wasn't doing any good. Taking recipes from the people for chicken with cream of chicken soup. I don't want to make that kind of thing. I don't want to address it. Better to stop the war by doing my hair, coaxing out amazing lift, peaceful waves, light-catching waft. Going to the War Resisters League tonight wouldn't have done any good anyway. Their protest song calendar didn't get one arrow through the armored beast. Lest we forget, the thing is covered in armor and is a beast. We'll have roast tarragon chicken tonight, and the freshest, best asparagus and pastes on toasts. I'm dreaming. There is no we, just they. I see them all in a flash, out commiserating in the yard in the dark. The troops, I call them when they betray me like this. You tell the troops to do things, and when they do them, you punish them. But not now. Now is the time for dinner. I pull the dead chicken out of the plastic. The chicken's been through hell and back. Or better put, though it was living, it's not organic. Out of timelessness and into this. Not defeatist, more artist. Not leftist, more painless, more hidden, more lawless. By that I mean I have no law degree. I'm a woman cooking. Not hopeless. Well, now that I look at it. Having been out in the world, I stood on a stage in a dark cabaret and spoke very clearly about what needed to happen. Journalists took note. Springtime commanded to commence, commenced. Suffering commanded to stop, stopped. Power changed hands, kept changing, became a sound, sounds. I walked right out of the front door, past all of them scribbling, took my path to cross the river. Oh, what a multitude of springtimes have been packed into my feverish body. I paraded over the bridge like a brown bear, like a Mayakovsky, full of natural force, the surge of flood, that's how I walked, not a contradictory thought, like a headstrong bird slowed by a fat breast, like a Great Dane, huge, head up, strong, lopping walk, a flamenco dancer walking, my clothes commanded to swish, from one end of the bridge to the other I walked, a show for anyone who might see, now that's someone spit fire, sure, split of lightning, ramrod, shining axe, glistening, steely tail of comet, a streak, a parade of one. Having become stuck midway across the bridge. After such a heady leaving, I'm frozen in the middle, unable to move, suspended looking at the water. There's smog on either side of the bridge, pollution twinkling. On one side are the Centers for Peace Studies, their research programs. On the other side are the grocery stores. I do want groceries. I want to stop the war, but I've been consumed with so many things, all the small actions that go into this, all of the preparing food and eating it, all of the dressing and undressing, not just showering, but singing in the shower, laundry. Small actions in direct opposition to the thoughts of the research centers, this cooking and then eating dinner in front of the TV, not watching satire, watching a singing competition. I want to walk deeply into the darkness, nude as a god, through the self, into the darkness. I want to blow up the law with language, having run my tongue around my mouth 10,000 times. Instead of not speaking, I want to speak. Having at least dressed appropriately, I want to forge the self with the darkness, with the dead, with the language that cracks out of study. Dressing for it is the starting place, backstage, cinching up into heavy gowns and a very commanding coat. When I'm acting commander, I move slowly, but with force. A fleet is waiting, with faces upturned. The decision I made hasn't crossed my lips. It's humming in my head. My throat is dry. I said I wanted to forge the self with the darkness, but that must have been a century ago. How could I have said such a thing? I've come out onto the stage, the balcony, the pulpit. The body needs light. The brain needs light. Study, yes, but even more brightness, light. I tell the troops what they're going to have to do. I shiver with dread during the time it takes to marshal them down the hallway into the very small room where the removal is to take place. It is a preservation of the self and a perversion of all else, and dressed appropriately or not, I can't speak well of it. In any kind of aftermath, the body needs to dream. Mine does. Those do. We dream together. I dream with those I've made complicit with me. Having dreamt complicit dreams. When God spoke to me, I didn't hear it, though it was a sensation. My hands were tying the sash of a girl's dress when I felt the reverberations of God's voice. I also felt God's voice in the parking lot when the homeless man confronted me. The abortion doctor had run away, finding me needy, too forward, but the homeless man in the clinic's parking lot, though terrifying, was needful of me. If God could be the serpent in the garden, then it is possible that God could speak to me. If a theology exists in which God is the opposite of the serpent, but capable of acting as the serpent, there is a chance that I've experienced the sensation of God speaking to me. Several times I've fed a baby at my breast, but only at one breast. The other has no milk. I've been handed a child, beautiful, shining blonde, with sunlight streaming all over us. When the child spoke, she said only, "Hello." And the night right after, that night I was chased. The man had a gun. I ran and ran. I found a compartment in a wall to hide in. Curled there, I waited in horror of what was about to happen. I don't know if any of the sensations were, but was that sensation the sensation of God speaking to me? Having committed something like an act of penance, I have humbled myself beneath the night sky and beneath the sky of early morning. I have walked a long way tied into a wool coat, the belt cutting my waist. Lie. I have walked a long way with the sun heavy and hot upon me. I have walked penance, lie, run penance, lie, worked slowly at a desk toward penance, big lie, chopped vegetables for stew in penance. I have lain on the bare earth, lie, on the bare floor, lie. I have waited in penance on the stairwell, lie. Though I didn't know that every movement of my body was penance, many lies, my mind, waking and in sleep, was committing acts of penance. Though penance cannot be paid, it must be paid. Though you benefit in no way from my penance, walking in the imaginary field, shivering in the dark, does open a sliver of the night sky through which I glimpse you. Unsayable. Being in love makes it hard to communicate with anyone in any way at all. I see it all and accept how little time there is, how foolishly I've spent it. This feeling of sinking, I can say this, you know it too. We're in love. Here we go. Down we go. The unsayable between us. We accept it. Having encountered a three-personed God. Disarmed, I am battered by a three-personed God, banished into the sacrament of a new body, a hut on a pond. This trinity of my body and yours has done it. My body, yours, and something else. Remind me again how this hut was built. It was built in a frenzy of male and female effort. Effort, that Protestant word. You happen to have taken the shape so perfectly of a man that I can't help but be lost in my distraction. My distraction takes on spiritual proportions. I'll say again, again, the world is going to hell in the cheapest plastic handbasket, and I'm moving farther and farther away from the world. I'm moving toward your lips. I'm moving toward you. Toward you, who refuse even to bend your knee, no matter what sin we've committed, no matter an error that can't be corrected or paid for, though you shut the door on it, though I've locked myself in rooms with it, I'm suddenly bewitched again with life. I'm moving toward you, fevered, grown full in my love for you, with another in tow who will look like me and who will look like you. I've been pent up in rooms high in towers paying penance, trying to communicate an impossible narrative to an impossible recipient. I shed my long skirts, my cape, my boots, laced to the knee, my layers of underthings for a shift. I found the rickety hut that I had begun to build long ago. This time the building was finished in a night, and I asked to be alone. I fished in the pond there and made small fires and did my work singing only to you. The mass of God who was in the trees around the pond heard this and set me with child. Now when I return, eyes flashing, hair full, face flushed, it is that I am coming back to the world. Not to the world I was fighting, but to this one, full of moon and sun. The paintings of the Spanish cathedrals are alive under my skin. The peonies of summer hang heavy when I wake. The man, the God-made man, strong as the many horses in the field, tender as the newly knitted bone, supple in half-dream, lies quiet when I, disarmed, go down to sleep. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Those of you at home, I'm afraid that you don't have in front of you what everyone here has, not just the readers, but all of the publishers have brought copies of their journals here. Lovely gifts for you for December. So note those that are around at the ends of tables and so forth. In fact, the issue of special issue of the magazine I'm about to introduce is, I have to say, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. So be sure to grab one of those. Speaking of that as well, if you do like one of these journals, if they speak to you, if they seem to capture your sensibility, which is what journals do, please subscribe to them. It really is the only way that they can keep going. It's very, very essential. So please support them by doing that. Next up, from Salt Hill, not one but two editors. For number two, we have a double. Both Kayla Blatchley and Aaron Chambers. Come on down.
I think our decision to tag team the intro largely came because the rock, paper, scissors was inconclusive, and I'm always trying to tell Aaron what to do, and Aaron does what he wants. He asserts that often. We'd really appreciate being invited and being here and allowed to actually be in fancy places. It feels pretty wonderful, so thank you. And we are very proud of our 21st issue, which we have out on the tables. Please take one. A lot of the design owes credit to Naji Minello, who is our fellow writer and friend. But yes, please take love. And the next issue should be out in January. So Salt Hill is a literary journal publishing outstanding new fiction, poetry, creative nonfiction, and art. Now over 10 years old, the magazine is published by writers affiliated with the Creative Writing Program at Syracuse University. Our upcoming issue, out in January, includes interviews with Edgar Corret and Lynn Tillman, a visual mapping of several major American novels by Steffi Kosovec, which is sentence diagramming. It's gorgeous visual illustration of the organization of sentences, chapters of novels. It's amazingly complex and gorgeous. New poems and stories by unpublished writers, and a short story by Phil LaMarche. Phil LaMarche has been awarded writing fellowships in both Prague and St. Petersburg, Russia. His novel, American Youth, was published in 2007 by Random House. More of his work has appeared in Esquire, Ninth Letter, and the 2005 Robert Olin Butler Prize Story Anthology. His short story, In the Tradition of My Family, has been made into a film by Orlatter Productions, and he currently teaches creative writing at Syracuse University.
I need to point out that I won Rock, Paper, Scissors. I just didn't know what I won, whether that meant I had to talk or I got the free pass. So now that I'm up here, what can I say about Phil LaMarche? Phil is a handsome man. Don't get any ideas. He's a married man. As you might gather for anybody who's read his work, Phil is one of the most smart, generous, and sincere people any of us are likely to meet. The first time I ever met Phil, I was new to the city of Syracuse, and it was a cold and unfamiliar place, as opposed to being cold and familiar. And it was only October, and I was already freezing my West Coast ass off. And Phil had organized a reading for the writer Heidi Julewicz. For those who are familiar, Kayla and I were in her workshop at the time, and afterwards, Phil took us all out to dinner, and he took us to this neighborhood pub, basically, this Irish pub in a peripheral neighborhood, and it was just one of these unpretentious, out-of-the-way, sort of soft-lit places that you can never find on your own. You need somebody to show you how to get to these places, and just to be new to a city and have somebody show you a local spot. It's a very generous thing. It's kind of like being told a secret. And being at this place, and it being October, I don't know why October, but it being October, in addition to regular pub fare, there were complimentary testicles being served. If memory serves, it was bull, sheep, and pig. And it was all you can eat. And we ate them. And that was my first introduction, and now knowing Phil, sort of upon reflection, it occurs to me that the experience was very instructive for reading Phil's work. Like the calm surroundings of the restaurant, Phil's prose is embracing. It reassures even as it dismembers. And I mean that sometimes, figuratively, always emotionally. What I mean to say is that Phil, rather than saying everything will be all right, Phil's work says, this is life, and that's all right. His writing loves the specific. Much like chewing sheep balls in a strange city, the full impact of Phil's work isn't immediately apparent. The breadth of his writing is difficult to swallow when one thinks too hard about it. It leaves it a distinct taste in the back of the throat. Part of the genius of Phil's writing is that his power is inconspicuous. He has a beautiful dialect, declarative style. A beautiful, direct, declarative style. Phil is never coy. Rather than hinting at awfulness, he shows it head on. Phil's is a prose that runs towards the difficult scene rather than away from it. The reader has to catch up. I can't think of a better compliment to give a writer than that, and we're both very happy to be introducing Phil LaMarche.
I'd like to thank both Aaron and Kayla for that nice introduction. I'd also like to thank the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses for all the work they do, and also the New York Public Library for having us here tonight. This is probably the nicest place I've ever read. and I'd also like to thank the Salt Hill Magazine, which will be publishing it. I'll be reading a truncated version of the story that will be published in their forthcoming journal in January. So this has been truncated, and hopefully it makes sense. It's called Small Spaces. On a walk in the cemetery with my friend Abe, I tried to tell him about my father. In my early 20s, he had gassed himself in the small shed behind my childhood home. All I could say to Abe was, "Burn me." It was the best I could do. The thought of all those bodies trapped in their coffins was making me nauseous. "Will you be sure they burn me?" "Can you?" Abe said. "Can Catholics?" "I don't care," I said. I tried to shake the thought of the boxes underground. I have trouble with small spaces. Sometimes all it takes is a heavy blanket. My wife gets terribly annoyed by my sudden thrashing in bed. I've tried to explain, but she says people aren't supposed to talk about those things. "Can Jews be cremated?" Abe shook his head. "We have rules." "You think they mean anything?" "If there aren't rules for how to treat bodies," he said, "there aren't rules for how to treat bodies." He pointed at his arm. "I like that," I said. He nodded like he knew I would. Abe's wife had left him for Montana, and my wife had a job while I didn't, so Abe and I had time. We did things often, but this was our first time to the cemetery. He lit a cigarette. He had beads of sweat on his forehead from the mild incline of the walk. After the cemetery, we went back to the cafe, where Abe had a crush on one of the girls who made coffee. We ordered glasses of water and shortbread cookies. They had excellent shortbreads. Abe flirted briefly, and we took seats. He always chose the one that looked back at the counter. I let him. I had a wife. "Women used to be so easy," Abe said. "Ha, speak for yourself." "Not like that," he said. "I used to be able to want whoever I wanted. Now I have to wonder." "Why not try someone more our age?" I said. "Then I have to wonder what a woman our age is doing single." "You're single," I said. "Should a woman wonder about you?" "Of course. What am I saying here? Are you even listening?" "You're depressing me," I said. "I'm trying to explain myself. What the hell are you depressed about? You've got a wife." "A wife who's going to leave me." "She can't. She's a woman. It's worse for them." "You're not helping. You're a baby. I wish you could hear yourself. It was just a job. She was just your wife." He held up a finger. I nodded, and I shrugged an apology. When I left the cafe, I went home. I read the list of chores my wife had left on the kitchen counter. I did the dishes from the dinner the previous night. I cleaned the toilets. I threw away the shower curtain and hung the new one. I folded the clothes in the dryer, and I rushed to get dinner ready by the time she got home. I really didn't need Abe making that baby comment. I wouldn't have made the wife comment if it wasn't for him calling me a goddamn baby. I was at the counter making the salad when my wife came in. I turned and kissed her quickly, but I kept my hands away. They were wet from washing the vegetables. "How was your day?" I asked her. "Same old shit," she said. "You didn't get to the lawn? What did you do?" I wanted to tell her that I had finished every single item on the list other than the lawn, but I knew that wasn't what she was asking. "I saw Abe for a bit," I said. She didn't particularly like me spending my days with Abe. She liked him well enough, but she knew we spent our days looking for women for Abe to have crushes on. I tried to explain that it was therapeutic for him, and she said that was fine, but she didn't think it was very therapeutic for me. We ate our salad, and then we ate the baked chicken breasts and rice pilaf. I didn't ask any more about her day because I didn't want her to ask about mine. After we finished, I cleared the table and went to the kitchen. I piled the dishes in the sink. I put water on the stove for tea and walked back out to the table. She'd moved to the screen porch, where she sat with the bottle of wine from dinner. She liked a glass or two with a meal, and sometimes she liked finishing the bottle off afterwards. It scared me, but I never said much. "Want me to take that inside?" I said, pointing at the wine bottle. She shook her head. "I need to unwind. It's stressful, being the breadwinner." She held up her glass as if to say cheers. I turned and went inside for my tea. The water hadn't quite come to a boil, but I poured it anyway and walked back out to the porch. "You don't love me as much as I love you," she said. "I do," I told her. "I love you." She smiled. I liked that about her drinking. You don't even love me at all," she said. "You never even loved me in the first place." I laughed. "See," she said, "I knew you never did. You're going to leave me for one of those little cunts." I walked over and bent to kiss her. I sat and took her hand. "She won't take care of you like I do." "I know," I said. We sat there until the wine was gone and it was dark and too cold. Then we went to bed. She didn't like it when she left for work and I was still in bed, so I got up with her. I made toast that she didn't eat. She kissed me quick on the cheek and she was gone. I did the lawn and I took a shower. Then I called Abe. He said he was going to the reservation to buy cigarettes, and I asked to go along. He agreed and picked me up. He got 3 cartons at a cigarette drive-thru on the reservation. He pulled over and tore one open. After he lit one, he held out the open pack to me, and I took one. "You sure the wife would approve?" he said. "How about your wife?" I said. "You're supposed to wait on the wife. That's the closer. I go baby, you go wife. Done. But I want it to end now." "Too bad," he said. "We're stuck with it. You big friggin' baby. That's what your wife calls me. Don't fuck it up next time," he said. I smiled and took a drag off the cigarette. As I exhaled, I told him that my father used to smoke. I liked the way the smoke came out with each syllable. "Is that what killed him?" I shook my head. "He did." "Did what? Killed himself?" I nodded. "Fuck, you never said that. Some people say it was an accident. What do you think?" "I just told you." Abe was quiet for a moment, and then he said, "You never talk about him. Tell me a story, something funny." I thought for a moment, and then I smiled. "Some winters," I said, "my family rented these motel rooms on Myrtle Beach. My dad and uncle would get sauced and hit the go-karts with us." I stopped and smiled to myself. My uncle once spun my father around backwards on the track, and instead of pulling over, he jammed the gas on and raced in the wrong direction. He played chicken with the oncoming carts until neither he nor my cousin Gary turned, and they crashed into the tires piled on the side. My uncle laughed so hard he gagged and almost threw up. My dad staggered around claiming to have a head injury. The guys who worked there didn't buy it, but they said they wouldn't call the cops if we never came back. I smiled and looked over at Abe. He wasn't laughing yet, so I kept going. My dad had this huge egg on his forehead, and he kept insisting he had a concussion. In the parking lot, my uncle finally said, "Bullshit, you're awake, you're talking, and the fact that you think you have one probably means you don't. Now, if you said you were fine, then I'd be worried." "Do you hate him?" Abe said, "your old man." "Why?" Because I would think you would." I shrugged and I shook my head. "Is this that Catholic denial everyone talks about? It was just a funny story, leave it at that." I said it a little louder than I had meant to, and I was suddenly uncomfortable. I could tell that Abe was too. We didn't talk for the rest of the drive to the pub on the east side. The waitress Abe had a crush on wasn't working, and I was afraid it would foul his mood, but our waitress brought out warm bread without our asking, and that pleased him. "I like her," he said. "We'll tip her well." "Any luck this morning?" I shook my head. My mouth was full of bread. "You guys should move," he said. "There's nothing keeping you here." "Nothing but her job," I said. "That's kind of a big one." "You could land a job easy someplace else." "She won't go for it," I said. "I wonder why." He said it without looking at me. "Listen, if you had the job and she didn't, you'd be the one calling the shots. She can't stand the thought of that." "That's not it at all," I said. "She just can't see giving up a really good job in return for having to move for one we're not sure about." "That's what she says." "Abe, don't. If I didn't give a shit about you, I wouldn't. But I do, and I can't stand to see you like this." "Like what?" "Completely emasculated." "What's that supposed to mean?" "Look it up," he said. "No, don't. You'll only get depressed, and you're no fun when you're depressed." "Hurry up and get to the baby comment so I can get to the wife comment and we can be done." "I already did," he said. "That's emasculated." "Wonderful," I said. "And so is your wife. Are we done?" "Sure," he said. "You don't get bored with it?" Last weekend, when she wouldn't let you out, I went 4 days without speaking to anyone. While this is indeed boring compared to the insanity my mind can cook up on its own, I welcome the break. "Jesus, Abe," I said, "you shouldn't do that to yourself. You say it like I have a choice." The weekend came, and my wife and I slept late on Saturday. I got up and cooked us pancakes and bacon. She came into the kitchen, still in her pajamas, rubbing at her eyes. I poured us coffee, and we sat and ate. "What do you want to do today?" she said. "It's your day off. You decide." She shrugged and went back to eating. "Will you still love me when I get fat?" she said. "How about if you get fat?" "Oh, I'm getting fat. You've seen my family." "Please don't get fat," I said. "I won't if you don't." "Easy for you to say," she said. "My family's fat as yours," I said. "Would you love me less?" "I've never been with a fat woman. Maybe I'd love you more. Who knows?" "The one before me was fat. Did you love her?" "I didn't, but she wasn't fat." "She had tits like a fat girl. Did you love hers more than mine?" "No," I said. "You bastard," she said. "You don't love me now. I don't stand a chance when I get fat." "Darling, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have reason to take another breath." "I love you too," she said. She leaned over to kiss me and left a sticky spot of pancake syrup on my cheek. I wiped at it with a napkin, but the paper kept sticking to my face. She laughed and leaned back across the table. She stuck out her tongue and scrubbed my cheek with it. "Thank you," I said. She smiled. "So, fat girl lover, what do you want to do today?" "Up to you," I said. "You want to see Abe? I have a friend at work. We should all four get together." "Abe likes ass. Does she have ass?" "Jesus, I don't know. I just want to let him know what he's in for," I said. "Guys, go for her. Call him." I did, and I lied. I told him she had great ass. I told him it was an 8 or 9. He got excited, and I was glad. I didn't want him spending another weekend alone. And it turned out my lie was only a small one. She was more like a 6 or 7. Not bad at all for a skinny girl. And she was pretty. Abe always made a big deal over the symmetry of the face. It was something I didn't really understand, but I looked close and I couldn't see any major differences on either side of her nose. She stood from the table when my wife and I arrived. They hugged, and she put her cheek against my wife's and made a loud kissing sound. We sat on the large outdoor patio. The sun was blazing, but there was a big umbrella staked through the middle of the table. My wife ordered a pitcher of wheat beer with lots of lemon. I ordered a tonic with lime. "No beer for Tom today," her friend said. "I don't," I said and smiled. My wife looked at me like I was kind of retarded, and I smiled in agreement. When the beer arrived, they talked about work. I shredded a napkin. "What do you do, Tom?" she said at a break in their conversation. "Nothing," I said and smiled. "I go to the cafe sometimes, the pub, with Abe. He's the one coming. The dishes, too, I do them." "Tom's a computer guy," my wife told her. "He's out of work at the moment." "What is it about wheat beer on a hot day?" her friend said, quickly changing the subject. "Tell me about it," said my wife. They both took long drinks. I was elated to see Abe coming across the patio, and Abe was elated to see her. He sat and ordered a Jack and ginger ale. "No beer for you either," Amy said. He rubbed his stomach. "Makes me crazy," he said. "I'm like a bottle rocket on the beer." "Sounds exciting," she said. "I'm not being figurative," he said. "I fly around the room and then I pop. It's pretty disgusting." She slid the pitcher of beer away from him. "How are you doing?" he asked me. "He's doing dissociated today," my wife told him, holding up her hands to put quotation marks around dissociated. "That's good," said Abe. "Anything's better than his depresso number." They both smiled at each other. "You guys suck," I said. "Even me?" Amy said. "I haven't figured you out yet. You might." "What?" Amy said, looking offended. "Abe's a writer," my wife told her. "Really? What do you write?" "Stories," he said. "What about?" "They're all different. What's the one you're currently working on about?" "Cum shots," he said. "Abe," said my wife. "As in sex?" Amy asked him. "Ejaculation?" She said it quietly. "How does that constitute a story?" my wife asked him. "This guy likes the way it looks on women's faces." "That's disgusting," Amy said. "He's not proud," Abe told her. "He's trying to come to terms with it." "Is it autobiographical?" Amy said. "Of course." "Abe," my wife said, "for Christ's sake. I'm just answering questions here. You want me to lie?" My wife shook her head, and Amy giggled nervously. They ordered and drank another pitcher of beer with my wife doing most of the legwork. Abe ordered but didn't finish a second whiskey and ginger ale. When the sun dropped out of sight and it started to get cool, we stood from the table. Abe and Amy said goodbye, but they left together. My wife and I left together, but we didn't say anything. She walked fast out in front of me, quick and wobbling. I jogged to get between her and the car and held out my hand for the keys. "What?" she said. "Come on," I told her. A pitcher and a half of beer was plenty for my wife. "It's my car," she said. "Get out of my way." I shook my head. "Walk then." She pointed in the wrong direction. "I'll call the cops," I told her. "What the fuck is wrong with you?" she said. "Me?" I said. "Yeah, what the fuck is wrong with you?" I used to lie across the back seat of my father's car with two seat belts on and a pillow over my face. "Why say that?" she said. "No one wants to hear your shit." "I'll divorce you," I told her. "That's funny." "I'll move," I said, "someplace I can find a job." "Bullshit," she said. "You've got 10 seconds before I call the police and a lawyer." I held out my hand again. You would. She started to cry. She threw the keys over my head, over the car, into the grass past the sidewalk. I chased them down and then corralled her into the passenger seat. In her sadness, she became more docile, but she kept telling me what a bastard I was. I stayed quiet. I've learned that no matter how they might bait you, it's better not to let a drunk bring you into their shit. Let them stew in it alone. That's what drunk tanks and padded rooms are for. The professionals know what they're doing. I drove cautiously through the city. The last thing I needed was to bang up her BMW. She treated it like her child, even though it was the cheapest model and used at that. I wanted to tell her that everyone knew what a heap it was, but I knew better. When we got to the house, I pulled up the driveway to the garage door and pushed the button of the remote opener. "Get out," I said. "What are you doing?" "Where are you going?" "For a drive." "No," she said, "no." Her sad, soft face was the bait. And once I went for it, it would be different. Very quickly, it would be very different. "Get out," I said. "You son of a bitch," she sobbed. She slapped at the dashboard, but eventually she did what I said. I have a half-hour loop I usually take, but some nights, instead of driving, I come to this park that overlooks the center of the city. The skyline is so modest that even atop this hill, I look down upon it. Abe has informed me that gay men come here to pick each other up, but so far I haven't been approached. There are indeed other men sitting up here alone in the darkness of their cars, but for some reason I imagine them much like myself, patiently watching the city, waiting for a safe moment to return. In the quiet darkness, I think about my dad. He wasn't a terrible person. There were times, sure, but there were other times. Making one person out of the two, living with the love and the rest, that's the hard part. The hardest, I think. He died during one of the big ice storms up north. They went days without power, and he got his hands on a generator. He brought it into his work shed and fired it up. The engine burned up the oxygen and clouded the small room with carbon monoxide. The firemen had to crowbar the locked door to get at him. Sometimes I wish I had found him. I wished I had arrived just in time, just before he passed, so I could have stood over him and kicked the son of a bitch from this world myself. Sometimes I get pretty mad. I pop the door and walk across the pavement. I stand in front of the car, staring out upon the city lights. I try to steady my breathing, but my body fights it. I turn quick and take a wild kick at the car. My toe crashes through the left headlight, and as I pull my foot free, the glass cuts through my shoe and lances the top of my foot. It burns terrible, and the pain only makes me more furious. I take a few steps back and get a good head of steam and kick my heel through the plastic grill. I do this twice more, and then I raise my foot and bring it down on the hood several times as hard as I can. I kick out the other headlight and then the brake lights at the rear of the car. On my way back to the front, I raise my leg high like a can-can dancer, and on its way back down, my heel clips the rearview mirror off the side. It rattles against the door, dangling from the wires like a dog at the end of its tether. By this time, I'm so mad that I turn and swing my fist as hard as I can at the driver's window. It implodes with a pop, and pieces of window fall like a deluge of freezing rain on the pavement. I draw back my fist, and I'm amazed that it doesn't have so much as a scratch on it. My destruction comes to a halt as I sit there, examining my hand in disbelief. Not knowing what else to do, I drive to Abe's apartment. I park on the street outside and see that his bedroom light is on. I'm afraid to leave the car with the busted-out window, but then I realize that if it's stolen, I'll be able to blame the damage on someone else. The idea is so appealing that I leave the keys in the ignition. I walk down the sidewalk and up the stairs to the entranceway. I look over the call buttons and press Abe's. I'm about to leave when I finally hear footsteps approaching. The door swings open and Abe stands there with only a towel around his waist. His fist holds the towel tight. "Wow," I say, "you're hairy." "Yes," he says. "What is it?" "I've got company." I fucked up. I throw a thumb over my shoulder in the direction of the car. Abe leans to the side to see around me. "Ouch, crashed your Beamer," he says. He looks at me, but then he looks back to the car. "How the hell did you get the front and the back?" "I kicked it," I say. His head cocks to the side for a moment, and then he smiles. "I love it," he says. He looks down at my bloody foot. "Jesus," he says, "is that bad?" I shrug. "I fucked up," I say, and my voice cracks. I hang my head. I take a quivering breath, and just then Abe reaches out and grabs my face. It doesn't hurt, but I'm disgusted by the thought of where that hand has recently been. "Don't be a baby," he says. "Go home and be a man." He puts a hand on my chest and pushes me back. "I got to get back in there or I'm going to lose my momentum. I'll tell you about it tomorrow." "Go," he says. "Divorce her. It'll be the best thing you ever do." I don't say anything, and he closes the door. I turn and walk back to the car, start it, and pull away. When I leave the lit streets of the city, driving becomes difficult without headlights. Luckily, there's enough moonlight out to see the painted lines on the pavement. I turn into the driveway, but I don't bother opening the garage door. It's loud, and if she's asleep, I want her to stay that way. I get out and push the car door closed as quietly as possible. I look at the car and survey the damage again. I could play stupid. I could blame a crowd of delinquent teenagers, but she'd still get pissed as hell and blame me for not putting it in the garage. I could tell her the truth and tell her just how mad her drinking makes me. I could tell her about my father, and when she tells me to stop, I could keep telling her. I cross the driveway and ease open the door to the kitchen. There's a light on, but the house is quiet. I go to the bathroom on the other side of the kitchen and take the first aid kit from under the sink. I doctor my foot. I limp up the stairs and slowly turn the corner to our bedroom. She left the light on, and I can see her in the middle of the bed. She always takes up the whole damn thing. She has a cotton nightgown on, and she's curled herself around a ball of blankets. She looks lonely and desperate and beautiful. I strip to my underwear, kill the light, and crawl in next to her. She turns her head towards me, and I can see the shine of her half-open eyes in the dim light. She kisses my cheek and pulls my arm around her. "Give me some covers," I whisper. She lets out a frustrated sigh and pushes the ball of blankets out of her grasp. I grab the hem of the sheet and pull it over us. I push my face into the corner of her neck and I kiss her there. I inhale through my nose, taking in the smell of her sleep. The bed is warm and so is she. My body melts into them. "I love you so much," I whisper. She nods. "Me too," she says. I pull her tight to me. "We have to do something," I say. "I know," she says. "I can't," I tell her. "Not like this. not anymore. She nods. After a moment, I feel her breathing go slow and heavy. I lie awake for some time, staring into the darkness. When I finally close my eyes, I see the small shed. In the darkness, the light from the window throbs with the uneven current of the generator. My father rubs the frost from a corner of the glass and peers out upon the frozen world. The snow glows wholly in the moonlight, and the trees and power lines look forlorn, burdened by the weight of ice. The moisture from his breath collects on the cold glass. His eyes look tired. Thanks.
Thank you. Before our final selection, I just want to quickly thank some folks who helped make this possible, namely the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, along with Friends of CLMP, a group of generous folks who help us out. The way that you can help thank them for making this evening possible is by taking the little tiny pencil in front of you, and before the evening's out, just fill out the quick little survey form there. Your feedback is really valuable to us to continue to get funding to make these evenings continue as well. And, of course, take the tiny pencil home as your memento. And, you know, perhaps pencil a short story, poem, or piece of creative nonfiction for your favorite literary journal. Last but not least, one of the true grand dames of literary journals. And, you know, all the genres we've heard here tonight, poetry, short fiction, and we're about to hear creative nonfiction, really do find a home in literary journals. Without them, it would be very hard for a lot of this work to reach its readers. So, again, please support these journals by subscribing to them. And now, last but not least, let me introduce Jackson Lears from Raritan.
Well, thank you, Tasha, Jeffrey, and Karen, and everybody else who helped bring us together in this extraordinary place. I have just a few words to say about Raritan. Thank you very much. And in speaking of Raritan, I can't speak of Raritan without first mentioning my companion tonight, our managing editor, Stephanie Vollmer, who week after week, month after month, translates the magazine from the metaphysical to the physical plane, without which we would not have these objets d'art on the tables in front of us. Now, just a few words of promotion for the magazine before I get to our speaker. Ever since Richard Poirier founded Raritan 27 years ago, it's been a place, as we like to say, where you can still hear people thinking for themselves. Well, what are they thinking about? Literature and the arts, personal essays and memoirs, poetry, and since I took over the editorship 6 years ago, popular music and media, history and politics, and fiction, which I've reintroduced into the magazine. I came up with a marketing slogan on the train into town, eclecticism with an edge and a purpose. And what I want to do with the magazine, what I think Dick Poirier always wanted to do as well, was to sustain the critical spirit, but also recognize the truth of William James's words. James is always one of my go-to guys. Real culture, he said, lives by sympathies and admirations, not by dislikes and disdains. I would add to that that real cultural criticism lives by discriminating appreciation as well as the exposure of illogic and the puncturing of pomposity. So what we want to do, what we want to continue to do with this magazine is to provide a site for the criticism, the interpretation, and the creation of cultural texts by the best thinkers and writers and artists we can find. So who writes for Raritan? Some of the most prominent thinkers and writers on both sides of the Atlantic: John Ashbery, Susan Stewart, Robert Pinsky, Marina Warner, as well as less well-known authors of conspicuous talent with fresh and original things to say. And that brings us to Reverend Schendler, our featured author tonight. Reverend Schendler has worked as a teacher and editor at Random House in the 80s, I discovered. Oral historian, radio producer. During the 90s, she lived in Europe, first in Prague, where she helped launch an English language newspaper and taught for several years at Charles University, and then in London, where she wrote a doctoral thesis on memory and the transition from state socialism to capitalism. Her writing has appeared in a number of publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, Poetry, Selma Gundy, Best American Poetry, 1999, and The Village Voice, and soon, the crowning achievement, Raritan, spring 2009. She's a research associate in the Department of History at Smith College and lives in Western Massachusetts. The piece she'll read from tonight came in over the transom. And this is one of the great things about editing a journal, is that you can still use that archaic phrase and it can still have a certain magic. It does to me anyway. There is a certain gift with every unsolicited manuscript, every gem that comes out of that pile. Maybe they're only one or two, but there's still something extraordinary about just having them float into you. So that is indeed what happened with this piece. And Reverend, in writing it, is indeed emerging into a new form, a genre without walls that blurs the boundaries between history and fiction in a sustained reflection on the past. She reflects on the history of a particular household, the home of the painter Thomas Aikens and his wife Susan. There are also guest appearances by Aikens' model, Helen Parker, and her, or rather his, Aikens, that is, pet monkey, Bobby. So the piece as a whole is unclassifiable, but we can call it a meditation on the artifacts that historians use to reconstruct the past: letters, postcards, photos, and a bronze life mask of Helen. What Reverend Schendler reminds us is how fragmentary such evidence is, how much the historian's imagination is involved in piecing the fragments together, and how challenging, illuminating, and ultimately political the process at its best can be. So, speaking as a cultural historian myself, I think that this is a hell of a remarkable accomplishment. But enough about me. Please welcome Reverend Schendler.
Thank you, Jackson and Stephanie, Karen, Tasha, Laura, and Phil. It's an honor to read with you. It's an especial honor for me to be at the library tonight, because in that wonderfully circular way that life can be, my father worked here in the 40s as a teenager for something like 17 cents an hour, and he was a runner in the stacks before they had everything kind of automated. The son of immigrants, he was raised by a single mother in Washington Heights. And he came back to the library in the 60s to work on his biography of Thomas Aikens. After the book was published, he received a letter from a woman in her 80s who told him that she had been a model of Thomas Aikens 60 years before. And she wrote to him that Aikens had made a life mask of her, and also that there was a monkey who lived in the household of the Aikens family. So this piece is called The Monkey and the Mask. I'll be reading about a quarter of it, and you'll have to buy the issue next spring if you want to find out how it all fits together and how I came to write it. Some of the images that appear in the piece, which really are central to me, that I started with the mask and with this idea of the monkey, and in a flipping through a book of Aiken's photographs, I found a picture of Bobby the monkey. So really, the piece comes out of my response to the images. I wanted to project them somewhere, but I just copied some so that you can see how bizarre they are. So the monkey in the mask is dedicated to the memory of Sylvan Schindler. Imagine a time before electric light. A woman was searching for her lover, a mighty stevedore who hauled carcasses into the rendering plants on the river. He had not come home. Two of their children were with her, the boy to translate, the girl for sympathy. She was worried whether the boy would understand enough, whether they'd behave and look clean. She let go of the girl's hand and leaned on a lamppost to remove a stone from her boot. They had almost reached the waterfront. "Try not to think," she whispered to herself. The smell of soap and rotting cabbages reached her nostrils and filled the hollow of her stomach. "For the love of God," the driver of a passing carriage yelled into the dawn, yanking the reins to avoid the joyfully careening girl. The calloused skin of the mare twitched at his whip as she craned her neck to see the child lying in the street. The faces of three passengers in the carriage, jolted from half sleep, darkened the window. White with fear of officialdom, the woman scooped up the girl, grabbing with her free hand the boot she had dropped, her daughter's limbs jangling against her as she rushed around the corner, the one heel clicking, percussive on the cobblestones. The boy noticed his sister's foot twisted in a funny way. Not yet feeling the pain, she was asking him about the white foam on the horse's chest. "Tell you later," he said breathlessly, struggling to keep up with them. The carriage resumed its route to the ferry, much to the relief of the three passengers, who sat back in their seats as though following a prolonged exertion. The leather sighed. One of the men murmured something about these people, such idleness, their cretinous movements, reproducing like rabbits. His comments hung in the silence between the tick-clock tick-click of the hooves and wheels. The three men were on their way to cross the river, carrying with them sacks of plaster, a pan, some tools, and some bread for lunch, in order to take pressings of the face, a death mask, of a great poet who had celebrated his subversive love in a new and vigorous language. Both the poet and the mighty stevedore had died the previous day, the one having appeared in a dream and then a poem of the other. Though she suspects he has died, the woman will continue searching for her lover, the mighty stevedore, and she will never find him. She and the two children vanish into the morning, now bustling with life. Only an accident without witnesses, for who would believe her, or a child, or a fishmonger, could connect her with the three artists in the carriage approaching the ferry? And yet, had they shut their eyes and been lulled into reverie by the jostling rhythms of the carriage, they might have seen in place of her face the faces of their young grandmothers or grandmothers' grandmothers, who resembled this woman, if not in features, certainly in posture. Women with strong shoulders, raising other people's children, on their calloused knees cleaning floors, or leaving their father's farms to work in the woolen mills. These ancestors' children or their children's children would harness rivers and level mountains, invent smokeless explosives, sell tainted horse meat to an ever-expanding army, and slowly amass their God-sent fortunes. And then, according to the custom of the time, the women would acquire black and Irish servants, the boys read tales of Indians, the girls become accomplished at the piano, and the men lecture at learned societies on progress, evolution, and stemming the tide of immigration. They would find a suitable family seal and establish philanthropic organizations to ameliorate the harsh conditions of their less fortunate brethren. And finally, they would commission portraits of themselves so that their progeny might remember them in attitudes untouched by doubt. The struggles of those ancestral women, torn from the hamlets or slums of their birth, alluded to only by a plume of smoke in the distant landscape. It was a time when art and science, particularly medicine, had not yet fully parted ways, when chemists and artists and aristocrats were burning themselves, tinkering with the new science of photography. No longer did people who sat for their portraits have to hold their breaths as their rigid expressions were magically inscribed onto a plate coated with a light-sensitive solution. They could blink or leap in the air. At the finest academy in the city, a young artist named Susan received instruction in anatomy, dissection, and painting the human figure. The fifth of eight children, Susan was the daughter of an engraver and a mother who discouraged Susan and her sisters from having children. Susan excelled in all forms of portraiture, winning prizes and commissions. It was suggested that she become a nurse. She laughed politely and continued her studies into her early 30s, by which time it was certain to all concerned that even the profession of wife would be closed to her. She had, however, attracted the attention of the academy's finest teacher, Tom, for whom she would pose naked in front of a white horse while he experimented with his new camera. With little fanfare or scandal, Susan and Tom were married. It was understood that Susan would move into the dark and narrow house in which Tom lived most of his life, at first with grandparents, parents, sisters, servants, and many animals. After his marriage to Susan, the household grew and contracted to include at various times nieces, a nephew, Susan's sister, and her companion, Addie, in addition to the cats, a noble line of dogs, a rat, and a snapping turtle. Susan laid down her brushes, directed the servants, filled ledgers with accounts, fed the animals. She composed and copied by hand most of Tom's extensive correspondence relating to his work, as well as the accusations of sexual impropriety, the breakdowns of his students, the suicide of his niece, the allegations of incest. And there was the incident in which he removed a loincloth from a male model in a class of students that included women, resulting in his dismissal from the academy. Susan's tears fell onto her careful script, and the words ran. She took a fresh sheet and began again. She understood that her story, if it were to survive at all, would be Tom's story, and she the first in a long line of its editors. As a young man, Tom had studied abroad and often strolled with his art school companion Harry through the recently opened zoological garden in Paris, lingering at the monkey house. They were both fascinated by the suppleness of these animals and passed many pleasant afternoons sketching and discussing the delicate sorrow of the monkey's hands. It was from Harry that Tom learned sign language. It was from Harry that Tom learned sign language, since Harry could neither hear nor speak. The two young men traveled together to Seville, where Harry was intrigued by the Romani musicians, the dancers and bullfighters, and purchased a few sketches by a young street artist, the first items in what would become a renowned collection. Not long after their marriage, Susan presented Tom with a capuchin monkey. Bobby the monkey greatly amused visitors with her lewd gestures and uncompromising tail. Chained to a circular platform in the dining room, she bared her yellow teeth at dinner guests. Bobby developed jealousies early on, particularly of Harry the dog, named after Tom's friend from art school days, who appeared in several of the paintings and was allowed to accompany his master to the saloon and the academy. When Bobby misbehaved, she was returned, sometimes too roughly, to her chain and circular platform. The Irish maid, Tuffy, took a liking to Bobby, and while dusting would whisper about the happenings upstairs, the young people coming and going, the peculiar ways of these artists, always dressing and undressing, even the women. On more than one occasion, Bobby scrambled up the banisters to the top of the house where the master had his studio. Once she paused for a moment at the door before sweeping off the shelves like a spinning dervish in crescendos of shattering plaster and dust. The fragile casts of hands, faces, and other body parts, living and dead, that Tom had fashioned with his students. Tuffy was secretly proud. One of the casts that survived Bobby's liberation from the circular platform was a life mask of a young woman, Helen, made at the time that Tom painted her portrait. Helen had beautiful red hair. An important element of the art student's curriculum was dissection. For many years, Tom shared his fascination with anatomy and dissection, as well as his studio and a camera, with his favorite student, Sam, with whom he made the mask of Helen. Of the cadavers that the Academy received, otherwise to be buried at public expense, most were in life people whose debts and diets resulted in poor musculature. And so it was with considerable awe one day that Tom and Sam discovered the body of a mighty stevedore in the dissection room of the Academy. If he was Italian or Irish or African, or if he had a name, these details were not recorded on the forms that accompanied his body. Tom and Sam were certain that never again would they encounter such a specimen of human strength. Their friend Walt, the poet whose death mask they were just finishing, would also have appreciated the beauty of the stevedore's form. Tom proposed a joint toast to the deceased. Teacher and student then began expertly skinning and sawing and casting section after section of the partially crushed body, sending a brief message home to Susan, not to expect them for dinner. The plaster forms they made that day, the whole of that night, and the following morning were used as models by students for many years afterwards and cherished by Susan. Following her husband's death, she had them cast in bronze and donated them to the museum. For decades, they lay beneath the city streets before surfacing in one of the galleries. Strolling through the empty museum during the Vietnam conflict, a young art student passing in front of the bronze torso was gripped as though by one of its severed arms. Her grandmother's stories of the waterfront and a mighty stevedore and the childhood accident that left her with a permanent limp came twistingly alive, like a rope thrown towards a pier. It may have been a form of simian dementia that afflicted Bobby at the end of her life, or quite possibly grief following Tom's death in 1916. She became even more protective of the cats, alert to any challenge to her love. Friends urged Susan to feed the monkey poison. According to an early biographer of Tom, who may be forgiven for not knowing that Bobby was female, Susan, when she was sweeping the doorstep, touched a kitten with the broom. Bobby misunderstood the gesture, broke his chain, and attacked her. Falling back over a stool, Mrs. Akins was helpless, and Bobby bit the length of her arm before she could get him stopped. Then Bobby was sent to the zoo, where Mrs. Akins and Sam Murray often went to visit him. Bobby would recognize the two while they were way down the road, and Susan and Murray were scarcely less excited than he. Or Bobby reached out a long arm through the bars, grasping with fine fingers at the approaching silhouettes. Their familiar gaits and smells filled her with expectation long before Susan and Sam gained dimension and became aware of her. Or she sat with her back to them, bare patches on her arm, pulling at her cracked and ancient toes, on the only occasion they could bring themselves to visit her. According to the Philadelphia Zoo, our records show a female capuchin monkey, Kebis apella, being donated to the zoo 13 September 1917 by Mrs. Thomas Akins. This monkey died 1 October 1919. The record notes that she was 27 years old when she died. We no longer accept pet monkey donations since they have social issues and wouldn't be able to be integrated into our existing groups, and they have unknown histories. And for the histories that are known, how much has yet to be invented and repeated in infinite variations, such as the conversations in sign language that Tom and his friend Harry had during their visits to the Paris Zoo in the 1860s, their fingers flying. A scholar of Tom's life recorded Harry's visit to Philadelphia during the Great War, just before Tom's death. Harry had accumulated a vast collection of art and brought his friend a small figurine of an organ grinder's monkey. Years later, in another war, Harry's widow, who was living in German-occupied Paris and whose name I am still searching for, managed to hide her late husband's collection, which had been deemed decadent by the Nazi Party. When she was finally apprehended for this crime, Mrs. Harry Moore was tortured, imprisoned, and put on public display in the monkey house at the Paris Zoo. Thank you.
Thank you. Just want to conclude by thanking Tasha Sorensen for creating this lovely evening. Please join me once again in thanking all of our readers and editors, and please join us right through those doors for our lovely reception. Thanks for coming. See you next year.